Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
We have in studio on Bowerly and Bellavia the Bishop of Buffalo. We also have the Canisius College president, John Hurley. And in the background, so many thousands of miles away, but still touching the hearts of many people in Western New York, what looks like the destruction of epic proportions in Paris, Notre Dame Cathedral. And before we get into the meat and potatoes of all of the local events, Bishop, can you just share your thoughts on what looks like is going to be the loss of not just one of the greatest relics of Christendom, but also a place of secular tourism pilgrimage?
You know, as I look at the images on TV, I just want to believe it's not happening. It is so tragic. It is just unbelievable, especially at the beginning of Holy Week. As you say, the Cathedral of Notre Dame is significant not only for religious reasons, that primarily, of course, a great symbol of French Catholicism, but as an icon of architecture and so many other things. It's just very, very sad.
I mean, I can't think of many, outside of Vatican City, I can't think of many more iconic structures within the Catholic faith than Notre Dame.
Of course, as glorious as the churches and other cathedrals, we remember as Catholics that, or any Christians, the church is fundamentally the people of God, the living, breathing community, more than the structure. But what a tragedy with a beautiful structure like that.
Indeed. And we will now move on to the local part of the program on WBEN.
Well, in studio, we have Bishop Richard Malone, and I don't know, and we have the president of Canisius College as well, John Hurley. Did you want to just put out a quick statement before we started and we could start asking some questions?
Sure, I'll be happy to start. I am here today, excuse me, as president of Canisius College, but also as one of the founding members of an initiative here in Buffalo that we've called the Movement to Restore Trust. And this grew out of, I think, a lot of anguish on the part of lay people in the diocese who watched last year as we had one revelation after another about the sex abuse scandal, and we really became concerned about the viability of the church and what might happen. So we took it upon ourselves to really look at this from the point of view of the lay people, and we began work in December, in early December. We had 150 or so lay people join with us in sessions that we began at Canisius College, but they fanned out. They met in other places. They worked very hard over a three-month period and developed a series of six reports in six different areas for the diocese, and we presented these reports, the summary of these reports, to Bishop Malone in early March. We unveiled them to the public on March 9th at a symposium at Canisius, and then we began to sit down and talk with the bishop about how might we implement these things, because I will tell you, there was skepticism. You know, we were going to do all this work, and maybe it was going to lead nowhere. But to the bishop's credit, he has welcomed the process, and he has embraced what we've said. It's not 100%. None of these things ever is 100%. But so far, it's almost 100% in the sense that we put nine basic kind of foundational recommendations in front of the bishop, and we said, this is what needs to happen to begin the process of restoring trust in the diocese. And he said, I can do those. And then we came back with specific recommendations that we prioritized. We said, these things look like early wins, and we think you ought to do those. And he said last Thursday at a meeting Thursday morning, I can do those. And so we've put a release out today that summarizes what those things are. And I'll tell you, from our point of view, this isn't the end of this. This is just the beginning. But it's a very hopeful beginning, and from our point of view, our group is there's a great sense of hope about the future.
If Bishop Malone had rejected five of the nine. Would you be sitting here today saying that I stand with Bishop Malone? If there was a disagreement where Bishop Malone said, I refuse to do this. Because people are going to say that you're loyal to Bishop Malone. You're loyal to the church. You're going to be here carrying the water no matter what. Is that true? Is that a fair assessment?
No, that's not true.
Where is your loyalty and allegiance?
My loyalty is to God. And,
there you go.
And we're trying to build the people of God through the church here on earth. And I've said this to Bishop Malone's face, and I'll say it again to his face. The church in Buffalo is going to be here long after he departs and long after I depart. So we're taking the long view on this. And you know, I'm a product of Jesuit education. Ignatius taught us we're supposed to discern God's will. And that's what we're trying to do, discern what God's will is for this church of his here in Buffalo during a very stressful time.
Bishop Malone, you also had an opening statement you wanted to get into before we get into the question and answer phase.
First of all, thank you, fellas, for having us on again. And I just want to say that I truly believe that the movement to restore trust and the steps that have been taken in a dialogue with those good folks, I think it's a working of the Holy Spirit. I don't want to get preachy or homiletic about this, but I really do believe that. The Second Vatican Council called for really a closer cooperation or even a sense of co-responsibility between lay leadership and ordained leadership. And it's not that there hasn't been that. There has been, but it's not been what it should be and could be. And I think we have something here that will not only help us to address the current crisis that we're in because of decades of abuse of people by ministers they should have been able to trust. They did trust them. That's the sad thing, and they were not trustworthy. But I think also it will bring the life of the church in Western New York to a healthier, stronger place as we move through this. And I think it's interesting we're talking about this at the start of Holy Week. Holy Week, of course, we think of Jesus and his suffering that he freely offered as he walked the way of the cross. He offered that for the salvation of the world. But I think also at this moment of victims of abuse by clergy and other church ministers, they are also walking the way of the cross and enduring terrible suffering. But unlike Jesus, it was not freely chosen. It was not intentional for the salvation of the world. It was just the experience of evil inflicted upon them. So I think it's a time for us to walk in new ways. That's one of the things we want to do, to walk in new ways with victims toward healing and justice. Believing as Christians that at the end of Holy Week is Easter, and at the end of the way of the cross is, if we handle it in faith and hope, is resurrection.
Now, there are going to be people listening who will say, yes, but how about the suffering of the victims? And they maintain that the church has yet to be fully transparent and that there are documents and cases all over the diocese offices which would show a deliberate cover-up of allegations.
Well, let me simply say that if there are documents all over the place, I have no idea where they are. I don't think it's true. In fact, I know it's not true. The documents regarding abuse have all been given freely to the federal folks who have subpoenaed us and the Office of the Attorney General. Anything that they've asked for regarding sexual abuse has been given to them. And we did that very freely and with a sense of cooperation. We want that. So I don't agree with that statement that's being made by some that we have all these other files someplace that we're hiding away.
You know, I was wondering if before you took the job as Bishop of Buffalo, if you were told as part of your job description that one of the big items you would be charged with addressing is the long-term, you know, the years-long allegations and actual cases of abuse. Was that a big part of the job interview or whatever you want to call it as bishop? Did you know what you were getting into?
Well, actually, to tell you the truth, there's no job interview. How you become a bishop, you get a phone call from the Pope's representative, the Apostolic Nuncio, that says you've been appointed Bishop of Buffalo. Do you accept? And I accepted.
So that's it. There
yeah,
was no,
that's
hey,
how, that's
you
how
don't
works.
Know what you're in for. Yeah. You should know what you're walking
but
into.
One of the first questions I asked when I came to Buffalo of my senior staff was this one. Can I be certain that any priest who had a substantiated allegation of abuse against him is off the job? is removed from ministry, and I was assured that was the case. The problem was, and I think I've told this to you fellas before, back in 2001, John Paul II decreed that every case of substantiated abuse by a cleric was to be sent to the Vatican for their adjudication. And that's when you would have heard that some priests were dismissed from the clerical state or given a lifelong penance, a sentence of prayer and penance. That would have been public information. For whatever reasons, that never happened until I started it when I came. So now we're in a process of catching up on a backlog of those cases. Every one of those priests is off the job and has been for years. But the cases now are on the way to the Vatican for their adjudication.
Bishop Lowe, let me just ask you, in November of 2018, more names entered. This is from the BuffaloDiocese.org website. Priests with substantiated claims of sexual abuse of a minor. Names were added in March of 2018. Names were added in November of 18. Do you have any personal relationship with any of the names from March or November you've worked with, you've known?
I've known some of the more recent ones. I, of course, knew them as priests who were functioning in the diocese when I came here.
But do you have any?
Have no personal relationship, you know, in terms of friendships or anything.
Let's say you had a personal relationship with one of these guys. What would be? I'm trying to get to what the allegation would be for a Bishop Malone at this stage of his career when. There is no cardinal above you. The Pope hasn't asked for your resignation. No one in your chain of command, if I could use that term, has said, we're very unhappy with the role that's played here. Why would you take the slings and arrows to your reputation, to the career that you've put, the dedication, life of service? Why would you endure that for any one of these individuals? There's no personal relationship here. The Catholic Church is already on record of paying cash settlements out to other victims of abuse. What's in it for Richard Malone to hide names? What would the argument be?
There is no argument to hide names, and so I've not done it.
So my point is that if the calls again for your resignation, we heard from St. Bonaventure President that came out. This last week, said very beautiful things about you as a man, about you in your role as a spiritual leader in the Buffalo Diocese. But he still said the president of St. Bonaventure University, Richard Malone, should resign because of, and it's the same echo that we hear over and over again. And I'm sure 3 months from now, there will be a new movement. You need to step aside. What if a bishop steps aside? What happens then? We get a new bishop in, and then do we not have the same questions of what happened 25 years ago, 30 years ago?
Well, I'm hoping during the last 2 or 3 years that I am still bishop, if the Lord allows that, that working with the movement to restore trust and others. We have to remember too. I mean, most of the pastoral workers in the life of the church in this diocese are lay people. We who are ordained are the minority, called to serve the whole church, which is mostly laity. So there's a lot of good people every day doing good work, and I need to continue to serve them. And I want to be part of this reform and renewal so that when I finish my term here, whenever that may be, we are, and I say this working with others like John and many other people, we are in a better place, more transparent, with any gaps in our system having been corrected. But I think it's my responsibility. I was sent here to shepherd this diocese. I didn't know a lot of the huge problems from the past that I was going to have to face. I made a couple of bad judgments myself with Yetter and Smith. I've admitted that many times, but I want to be part of the renewal.
But when St. Bonaventure's president, and I'm not trying to add to the sports rivalry of Canisius and St. Bonaventure here, but as president of Canisius College, I would like your comment to my commentary here. I thought that was totally out of line. First of all, if you're gonna go after Bishop Malone, why should he resign unless he's committed a sin or done something that he should apologize for? You claim that he's a spiritual leader, he's a good man with a beautiful heart, but then you take the other side after, what, a year? He's a president for the year of a school. I'm hearing from people left and right that are alumni of St. Bonaventure that are completely ashamed that their president has come out with a statement like that. Why not be a part of the solution? Why stand from the outside? Why isn't the president of St. Bonaventure with the president of Canisius trying to heal and get victims the proper love and security rather than throwing slings and arrows from the outside? How do you look at that as President Canisius?
Yeah, well, David, that's exactly it. When I issued my first statement on the church's sex abuse scandal back at the end of August, I was surprised. It immediately went viral in a way, and I was hearing from people all around the country. But the first media attention here in Buffalo was people would ask me, well, are you calling on the bishop to resign? And from the way I look at it, that seems to me to be kind of a knee-jerk reaction that you have with politicians. We saw it down in Virginia with the governor of Virginia. We see it with the attorney general of the state of New York. If someone does something wrong, they should resign. And, you know, I said, well, that's not my place as the president of Canisius College to tell the bishop he should resign. That's the bishop's responsibility or the people in the church hierarchy. My role, I felt, was to look beyond the personalities and to look at the church and to say, how could we be a part of the healing process? And how could we be a part of becoming a new voice for the rights of victims who are desperately seeking justice and healing?
So, but if I look at this movement to restore trust right now, you're stating your reputation that this is actually, we're moving towards healing. We're actually taking this horrible, disgusting, animalistic sin, and we're actually putting light on it. And we're identifying victims, and we're identifying the people that committed these atrocities, and we're moving forward. I'm saying now, more than ever, does the diocese need Bishop Malone to continue the course of what he's doing now?
Well, there was that part of the calculation that I made. If Bishop Malone were to step down today, we would have a temporary administrator for a period of time. And when Rome was able to identify a new candidate to come and be bishop, we would get a new bishop. But remember, Bishop Kimmick had submitted his letter of resignation, and it took over a year for Bishop Malone to arrive in Buffalo. And frankly, as we looked at the condition of the church this summer with all the revelations, we weren't sure that we could sustain that period of inactivity. What we've found now as a result of our work is Bishop Malone has reached out and has embraced the work and is committed. He tells us he's committed, and he's told us again here today in the studio, he's committed to this process of reform. We've done our best to try to outline what we think that means. I'm not sure that we have the complete answer, but we've got a good start on this, and we're off and running.
And you should know, if I could add in, we formed a joint implementation team of a few people from the movement to restore trust and a few people from the diocese. And that was the significant first meeting of that group we had last week. And I thought it was, again, not to theologize this much, but I felt the grace of God at work there. It was cordial, it was candid, and there was a sense that we want to move forward together for the healing of the church and healing of victims.
Mr. Hurley, in recent days, you have been accused, given your position with trying to make reforms, you've been accused of becoming too close to Bishop Malone. Do you agree with that? Have you gotten closer?
I have had a relationship with Bishop Malone since he came to Buffalo. As a president of a Catholic college, you need to have a good relationship with your local bishop, because there are lots of issues involving the Catholic Church that come up on a Catholic campus, and we need to have a dialogue all the time. So we already had a close relationship. The question here on this is, you know, and I've heard this, are we too close to the bishop, and will that impair our objectivity?
Right. Is there a conflict of interest?
I don't think there's a conflict of interest, and I don't think it's impairing our objectivity on this. We've been very candid in our remarks about the situation.
We are honored to have the Bishop of Buffalo, Richard Malone, in studio, this time with the president of Canisius College, John Hurley.
Well, want to play for you a question by a gentleman named Robert Hotson. He's a Jersey former priest. He runs an organization called Road to Recovery. He had a question specifically for Bishop Malone, and here it is.
Bishop Malone, how is it that you are admitting your own incompetence by establishing this committee to restore trust, which means that there is no trust, and number two, that you assembled a group of lay people to tell you how to handle this issue, which says to me that you as the bishop are admitting that you cannot be the person to handle adequately cases of clergy sexual abuse against children, against teenagers, against vulnerable adults. So why are you staying?
There's a very easy answer to that question. First of all, let me correct the question asker there. I am not the one who can claim the responsibility of having established the movement to restore trust. That was a group of very committed Catholic lay women and men working with John Hurley at Canisius, who hosted these gatherings, who really want to work together with me and with the diocese to move forward. And so that's answer number one. Answer number two is no, I can't do this all by myself. When bishops feel they can provide all of the leadership of the church on their own, that is when bishops get in trouble. And so I look forward to the insight, the input, the challenges, and also the support that will come from my relationship with Movement to Restore Trust.
And again, we are hearing this is the common denominator of all of these allegations are if only Bishop Malone steps aside, that we will only get true transparency and progress when you step aside. And again, we're looking at least a year to replace the bishop, and we're bringing someone in that has, you know, any case that's now to be adjudicated with a victim or an allegation, a substantiated allegation against a priest, we're hitting the reset button on that. Is this about victims, or is this about having a scapegoat? We need a bad guy. This was such it hit all of our hearts. It hit all of our souls. There are people suffering out there, and a lot of people love to scream about negativity. Where's the focus on the healing? Where's the focus on moving forward? I thought that was the entire point of the movement to restore trust.
And it is. The healing of victims and the healing of the church, part of which will call us and call me as bishop to move in some new directions in dialogue with my partners of the laity. And so we do this with great hope, and it is for victims primarily. So believe it or not, you don't hear this very often, but I am around the diocese all the time. I'm in the schools, I'm in the parishes, and there's much more support for my staying on than you'd ever imagine from some of the media. Now, I have to thank our journalistic friends. The media, you people are doing your job. You have to tell the facts as they are, but let's make sure they're the facts. And
Do you feel that this is a personal this is personal between you and some of the other people in the media? I'll talk about Charlie Specht at Channel 7. Do you feel that the coverage that you've received at Channel 7 has been fair?
Well, all I know is a lot of people pull me aside as they visit the parishes and tell me they don't feel that it is fair coverage. I don't wish to comment on that. I don't want to start a whole discussion in that regard. Media people have to do their work and do it responsibly. Others can make the judgment whether that's responsible or not.
You know, there are many paradoxes in this, and one of them is if you had not gone to lay people, if you had not brought inclusivity to the process, then you would be accused of being literally Your Majesty. You know, I mean, that people would accuse you of not having an open ear to the suffering of victims. So it's a no-win situation. You're going to be criticized no matter what you do.
Well, Tom, let's be clear, too. It's not a question of the bishop having brought in the laity. We injected ourselves
exactly
onto the scene and said, we think we have something to offer here. And to be honest, when we started in this process, we weren't sure what the reaction was going to be. There could have been a negative reaction, as David said before.
Well, before any of this was front and center, before 60 Minutes, the Bishop Malone story was that his car was stolen, and I believe it was like a Nissan, you know.
It was a Toyota. Yeah.
Toyota. Your car was stolen. A guy took your car from your home, and you forgave the guy. And you got the car back, and the story of Bishop Malone was, hey, he had his car stolen and basically gave the guy a hug and forgave him. And now it's, he lived in a giant mansion. How could he live in a giant mansion that's worth all this money? Well, you sold the mansion, and the money went to victims. And it's still not good enough. And people are going to say, what model Toyota was it? Was it Corolla? Was it a Camry? It doesn't matter. There are people that are just bent against the fact that you are the bad guy in this. You had nothing to do with these personally. And you feel that. And so for the fifth time, Bishop Malone, are you going to resign?
I am not going to resign. And there's plenty of support everywhere I go. Last year, one of the television stations, I don't even remember which one it was, reported twice that Bishop is hiding away. I haven't hidden at all. I have been doing all of my ministry everywhere I'm scheduled to do it, enjoying being with the people. I'm at receptions after the confirmation ceremonies and chatting with folks. And that's been a lot of my strength, actually, coming from the regular people out there in the pews.
Well,
I told you that. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say the last story that just came in the news, these 25 priests. We've heard, you know, the Channel 7 story was hinting at the fact that these were hidden, that we didn't know anything about these priests, that all of a sudden when we asked you a question in November of 2018, are there any more people out there? And you stated, I've got the audio right here. You said that I know of now. Everything that we can put out there, we're putting out there. So what is the truth about those 25 priests?
The truth about those 25 priests, and we've said this so many times, I guess you have to keep repeating these things, so thank you for asking, is that those were primarily deceased priests for whom one allegation had come in after their death. And we, like many dioceses, we didn't make this up, and this was not just me, it was our review board. We made the prudential judgment that we would not put the name of that priest out in the public if there was one allegation that came after he died. We decided if there were two after the priest died, that's something to pay more attention to. Where there's more smoke, there might be some fire there. And we have followed that consistently. It's unfortunate, though, that because those names were taken from the diocesan offices and made public, that there's been some very, very significant suffering on the part of the families of some of those deceased priests who just have to bear up under that right now. We've had quite a few phone calls from people.
So let me just ask you point blank. Are you resisting the release of photographs of priests who've had substantiated allegations, two or more allegations made against them? Are you resisting their names to go public?
Their names are public. If we have two or more, those names are public. We are going, part of my commitment with the movement to restore trust is with them to find ways that we can be more transparent about some of the information about accused priests. Whether we would put photographs out or not is an undecided thing. We certainly can consider that.
But we have, I just want to say, we have members of Congress who have been accused by multiple people that have no requirement of transparency. They're not on any list. We have people in the SUNY system. We have Buffalo City School educators that have had one allegation. There's no demand for transparency. But this is all about... again, the deceased priests, there is nothing here. It's all about transparency. It's all about saying we have nothing to hide whatsoever. And as you stand here, as you sit here, you're saying that you have no issue releasing the photo IDs of substantiated. The names are already out there. If the photos help and these people are dead or alive, you would support releasing that.
If we have a
substantiated allegation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
It is Bowerly and Bellavia in studio with John Hurley, president of Canisius College, and, of course, the Bishop of Buffalo, Richard Malone. To date, in the aggregate, how much money has been paid out in compensation to victims of abuse?
You know, we don't have, this is going to sound like I'm hiding something, and I'm not. We don't have the final figure on that because the independent reconciliation and compensation program, I always have to pause to get that right, the IRCP,
to use the shorthand, is just now wrapping up. And we want to give a full report on the amount of money, the number of cases and all of that when we have that, which we will do.
But checks have been cut.
Oh, yes.
But you don't know in the aggregate roughly how much?
I do not know. I know it's a lot of money that we've had to take from diocesan reserves, but we don't have the total yet.
So far, are you able to tell us what the maximum amount of financial compensation has been received by a victim?
You know, I don't recall. Do you, Kathy? Was it around 500,000 or six?
Five or six. That's a ballpark figure. $500,000 or $600,000 the maximum
range,
amount.
I think. Yeah.
You know,
what you have to remember too is that these amounts are determined by totally independent administrators of the program, two former judges. So we don't have any say at all about what the amount will be. If we think it's too much, we can't say that. If we think it's too little, we can't say that. So, but we are going to give a full report.
Let me ask President Hurley real quick. We've heard, we've been just talking nothing but Catholic priests. About a month and a half ago, we heard a report that came out of a couple of peer-reviewed, it was basically about nuns, about sexual abuse of women in the Catholic Church. Nuns who had been abused, nuns who are abusing. With everything that you're doing in the Buffalo Diocese with the movement to restore trust, is there any allegation, current, past, of any nun that has worked at the Buffalo Diocese of either being a victim of abuse or of abusing as a nun?
Not sexual abuse. I will tell you that in our work, we were looking at the role of women in the church, and there is a very strong feeling among many of our members that women have been marginalized in the church for a long time, and they may have been unhappy about it, but it didn't rise. It wasn't sexual abuse along the lines of what you're talking about.
So whatever national story is out there of the Catholic Church dealing with it, this just is not something on your radar yet that you've heard any substantiated allegation against any nun?
Not that we have heard, no.
And Bishop Malone, I don't know if any comment. Just because we're talking only about Catholic priests does not mean that any story of substantiated abuse, no matter where it occurred or how it occurred, you would still treat it the same way with the same transparency as you would a Catholic priest.
We really have to expand the way we look at this. You're right. The focus has been so much on clerics for obvious reasons. Most of the horrible, almost all of the horrible harm that's been done has been done by priests, sadly, and which is still, I don't say this to be defensive, which is still a very small minority of all the priests who have served in this diocese since we were founded. But as far as I know, the cases I've heard of abuse of nuns, which is a tragic thing, has in the news lately has been mainly in other parts of the world.
Right.
Where we've heard some terrible, I heard a terrible story the other day that somewhere, I think it might have been India, a bishop.
In India,
yes. Was it India?
It was in India.
A bishop had been involved in terrible abuse of a nun.
And there's also European stories as well. It's not predominantly a North American issue.
But you know, when the window opens for the filing of lawsuits under the new Child Victims Act in the middle of August, I think the general public is going to see that this epidemic of pedophilia, sexual abuse of minors, is not restricted to the Catholic Church. It's going to show up in any place where adults have had access to minors, and maybe that's going to change the narrative. Not that that makes it any, it actually makes it worse, because I think people are going to realize it's far more pervasive than people want to admit.
It's horrible, horrible. Bishop, what criteria must be met in order to make public the names of priests who were falsely accused of sexual improprieties?
Well, we have announced those once we have gone through a thorough process, and the investigatory process now is very, very thorough. We have three investigators. One is full-time. Two others we retain. These are people with all kinds of experience in doing investigations. And so when that has come to us, and the review board, which is independent and primarily, there's only one priest on that review board, which the charter requires. The others are lay people and very competent, dedicated people. Judge Selma Tocci right now is the chairman of it. They have sometimes a lengthy debate and discussion about
what will be the recommendation to me? Is this allegation substantiated or is it not? And when it is not, we have issued media releases on that, and we will continue to do that. But I never feel like we do enough.
But only after, I just want to point this out, only after a thorough investigation exculpates the falsely accused priest.
Absolutely. And a decision is never made on that by me without the, and we look for a unanimous recommendation from the review board.
Now,
and
sure.
I sit and listen to, I'm not a member of it, I don't get a vote. But I listen to every word they speak.
Surely the Catholic Church, who no one is joining the priesthood now, right?
Good news. We're going to ordain 8 young men.
Okay, this
June
is what
1st.
I want to talk about.
The most we've ordained since 1983.
And wow. I want to ask about these 8 priests that are being ordained on June 1st. Their background checks, their vetting. Is it safe to say that what goes into being a priest today, which, by the way, speaks volumes with all of the negativity out there, for someone to voluntarily do this shows that this is what their walk, this is what they feel they're compelled to do. What's their background check like compared to 25 years ago? How do we know?
Oh, it would be much more thorough. Since the Dallas Charter, any church minister, whether ordained or to be ordained or lay people or just parish volunteers, have to go through different kinds of checks, and all have to do, and if they want to continue in ministry, even as a volunteer, they have to take part in this program of protection called Virtus, protection for children and young people. I have to do that too. In fact, the day I arrived in the diocese, I was installed on a Friday, and I went into my office that Monday morning, and on my desk was the form I had to fill out for my background check to be done again, now that I'm in a new state. I'm not anymore in a new state, but when I came here from Maine. So it's very, very thorough.
In 2019, because of all the attention, because of all of the light that has shined on the church, in 2019, this is the safest place you could put a child. Because you don't have all of the I want to say loopholes, but there were so many circumstances that would find people alone, that would find people in a position where those don't exist anymore in the modern Catholic Church.
No, we really, it took a lot of pain of people to get us to where we are now of victims. But we're in a different place. That's what people have to realize.
And how many reported substantiated cases have we seen in the modern era?
We've seen since, I think, the year 2003, and they were all removed from ministry in this diocese.
In this diocese.
And we have confirmed.
Or 2001, early 2000.
And we have confirmed, by the way, that the highest amount so far that has been agreed to in terms of compensation is $500,000, $500,000. That is a confirmed number. On the other end of the continuum, on what basis are victims excluded from the compensation process?
Well, they have to have, and the other dioceses have similar structures in place. In our case, the abuse had to have been reported to us before March 1st of last year. And then they had to apply for that, and then it would be accepted or not by the two administrators. And they used their own criteria to determine the amount of the award. They would look at the gravity of the offense, how long it went on, how many victims there were by that particular perpetrator, all those kinds of things. But once again, we weren't involved in that in any way at all. That was entirely their domain.
You know, sometimes when you're ill, the worst days, right before you get better and you get that virus out of your system, that temperature spikes, you get the really bad sore throat, you go through the worst of the storm, and then you're on the other side of it. As you look at this entire scandal, as you look at the Buffalo Diocese right now, where are we in terms of healing and getting beyond this? Are we close to the end? Are we going to be here in 5 months and hear about...
We're not at the end of this at all. We're not out of the woods yet.
Are we at the end of the beginning?
At the end of the beginning... That's a good question.
That's stolen from Churchill.
You want to comment on that?
Well, I think the unknown here is the impact of the Child Victims Act and the lifting of the statute of limitations. So, in fact, we talked about that at our meeting last week. There is going to be another backlash in mid-August when people realize that other claimants are coming forward, including claimants who couldn't take part in the compensation fund. They would be eligible to commence lawsuits if they met the requirements that's in the state legislation.
And we may very well hear additional names of priests who've been previously accused.
We could well.
We could hear that there are more victims. And they couldn't apply for the compensation because the statute of limitations had run out. That is now exempted. And so we may hear more. But as far as this, we're going to hit a pocket where, 55 new names come out. Or, another storm, 60-minute scandal, there's a federal grand jury, all the... When you tell people right now that are worshiping on Sunday, what is the future of the Buffalo Diocese? Is it more shame? Is it more, should we have morale? What do you give the state of the union as far as the church in Buffalo?
Well, the church still, by the church I mean all of the people of God, including victims, are still scarred and wounded by all that has happened and continues to be experienced by people who will bear these wounds for life. And we know that the monetary awards are almost just symbolic. They don't ever reach deep down in a person and heal those wounds. There's no question about that. I know that. We all know that. But I do think we're doing the right things now. We're planning the right kinds of actions with the movement to restore trust. The diocese, has so many things going for it. The laity are active. We have just under 600,000 Catholics. Is everyone going to church? No. That was the case before the crisis. We still have to work on evangelization and help people to come to know Christ more personally. But I live in hope. This is Holy Week. It ends with a burst of light and hope on Easter Sunday, and that's the light in which I live.
Very briefly, to what extent or in what ways has going through this crisis as the leader of the diocese changed you? I don't know anybody who has not been changed as a result of going through what you've gone through.
Well, I'll tell you one thing it has done. It has changed me by making me, the times I have met with victims, sometimes people say the bishop doesn't meet with victims, and I have met with many, many victims before I came here and here. And that's one of the agreements with the MRT, the Movement to Restore Trust. I'm going to provide even wider access for victims to come and meet with me. But sitting and listening to a victim, and when I am with a victim, I don't talk much. I listen. And I promise them that I care for them. But when you listen to a victim and you find tears in your own eyes, it changes you. That's number one. Also, as I experience whatever it is that's keeping me strong in this, and people are quite amazed around me because I still am strong, even with all the arrows that I shot at times. I know that's God's grace, and I know it's good people and my staff and others I meet and my good priests and a lot of good people. I got 3 or 4 notes today, just notes of encouragement, hang in there, and we're going to do it with God's help.
Bishop Malone, Mr. Hurley, thank you very much for joining us in studio again on News Radio 930 WBEN.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.